thanks, and good afternoon, everyone. And I'm also just in the process of pulling up the the daily schedule so I can log into the Adobe room. But this is a working session of the. I'm going to say a bunch of alphabet soup here, so just bear with me if you're a newcomer. This is the IRTP Part D PDP Working Group. And what that means is IRTP is Inter-Registrar Transfer Policy. Part D, just as it sounds, this is the fourth in a series of working groups to address this policy and make improvements and recommend enhancements. And PDP is ICANN's policy development process, where any new policy or changes to policy that will be contractually binding on contracted parties must follow a PDP in order to legitimately be included in our contracts. So before we get started, we should note that the rough agenda for today, and I'm sure we'll have a better one here in just a moment, but is that we will conduct ourselves as though this group has been meeting weekly, more or less, for slightly over a year, and we will conduct ourselves according to one of our existing meetings. We're very close to the end of the process, so we have some outstanding. You'll see it's mainly a list where we will cover the outstanding items that we have between now and our final report. And then we would certainly like to allocate some time towards the end of the session where anyone who is maybe just coming into this issue or maybe is more casually following it and says, hey, you know, I don't understand why you guys are discussing this issue, or hey, I have some thoughts on this topic. We want to give anyone in the audience an opportunity to weigh in on those issues. So with that, and I'm still, as I said, trying to pull up the actual.
I just put on the short link there, James. Tell you other conferences.
Oh, thank you.
That'll get you to the Adobe Connect.
Well, that's kind of a chicken and egg scenario because it is the link to the Adobe Connect room. Can we post it in the Adobe Connect room?
Good afternoon, James. Andrew Gary here. Mark, okay. The Adobe room is back now.
Okay, I didn't.
You want to throw it up there?
No, I maybe misunderstood what you were saying. So, okay. But before we get started, let's dispense with some preliminaries here. If we could please go around the room with some introductions, name, affiliation, and then we'll also make sure we allow folks from the audience an opportunity to introduce themselves as well as the folks who may be on the bridge. So, if we could start down here, please, with the gentleman on the very end.
Wibram Braakman from Realtime Register.
Theo Gerds, Realtime Register.
Lars Hoffman, ICANN staff.
Barry Cobb with staff.
Volker Greimann, Key Systems Registrar, GNSO Counselor.
Graham Bunton, Two Cows.
Chris Pelling, Net Earth.
Marika Konings, ICANN staff.
So James Bladel, GoDaddy, and co-chair of the group, effectively chair because our other co-chair is no longer co-chairing, and registrar and GNSO counselor.
My name is Arthur Zonneberg for Hostnet, a Dutch registrar.
I'm Gary Arnold with HIBU.
Benay Garcia, HIBU.
Stefan Legner, InternetX, German Registrar.
Andreas Bartels, Deutsche Telekom, also German Registrar.
Holly Race, Internet Society of Australia, at large advisory committee.
Thanks, and now let's start with the audience here, and with you, sir.
Gijan Bogaerts, I'm a member of the Legal Committee Association of Registrars in the Netherlands.
Zuhra Kasap, ICANN staff.
Sahar Sauroğlu, ICANN staff.
Jan Agranik, ICANN compliance staff.
Dan Rogers, Paragon Internet Group, registrar.
Nathan van Overloop, Open Registry.
Philip Struijf, Nexpert Team.
Laura Jadid, LegitScript. Lindsay Hamilton Reed, 1-1.
Jasna Khalat, Cum Laude.
Mike Murphy, Cum Laude, registrar.
Mir.cdg register.ca registrar.
Okay, thanks. And anyone on the phone, can we give participants on the audio bridge an opportunity to identify?
Thanks, James. Angie Graves here, Web Group Incorporated. Thank you.
Hi, Angie.
Barbara Knight with VeriSign, also representing the stakeholder group, or registry stakeholder group.
Hi, Barbara. Any others? Okay. So, as per our normal operating procedures, does anyone have any updates to their statements of interest that are on file with this working group or posted in the community wiki? Anything they would like to declare? Raise your hand. Okay, seeing none. We also have a draft agenda that is on the, looks like it's on the right-hand side of the Adobe Connect there, beginning with a status update of the work. Does anyone have any other items they'd like to include on the agenda? If not, let me know. We'll pick those up as we go along. So the two things we wanted to accomplish today was, first off, just summarize. Three things. The first one would be to summarize where we are as a working group and what remains in front of us, between us and the finish line, because I think that we, a lot of us are we want to anxiously bring this effort to a close. However, we want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence on the issues that and the charter questions that we've been. You're going to have to hit the mute button, whoever just did that. And Holly. Mute button. Thank you. The sound is now going to Australia and coming back to London via Holly's.
Yeah, that's a nice delay.
It is a nice delay. At least we know now how big the Earth is. Thank you. That's good. That's always good for a laugh. Okay. So we want to update the remaining items that need to be done. We want to confirm some of the items that are effectively finished and make sure everyone is comfortable with where we've landed on things like the definitions and use cases. And then we want to take a look at the remaining outstanding issues that were collected during our public comment period, and then open it up for Q&A for anyone that wants to weigh in on these issues that hasn't been a regular participant of the working group but has an interest or a question on those topics. So with that, I believe the update, that, and particularly the update that Lars and I presented to Council on Saturday, was that the working group had anticipated that we would be finishing our work by London. This did not occur. But it did not occur for some very good reasons, encouraging reasons, which is, unlike some of the previous other working groups in this area, we received some very numerous and very healthy comments in the public comment session, which caused us to then go back and re-examine, and in some cases, reopen the discussions that we'd had relative to our charter questions. I think that's encouraging. That's a good thing. It means that the process is working and that it is taking on board those comments. And in fact, one of the bits of feedback that we received on Saturday was that this is the way we handled those comments is probably a showcase for how the system is supposed to work. Not necessarily speedy, but thorough and focusing on doing our due diligence. We also took a second, a third, and fourth and fifth look at our definitions list, which I think number of us had some substantial modifications that we wanted to see made, and I think we're all now in a place where we can say that we're happy with the definitions list. We have a couple of items remaining, specifically the addressing the role of the registry in as a first level dispute, the necessity of FOAs, and the third one was. Thank you. The change from the statute of limitations from 6 months to 12 months in order to file a dispute. Those three issues are still open, and we need to determine whether or not our original recommendations as contained in the initial report still stand or need to be modified or addressed to incorporate those changes that we saw during public comment. So maybe we can start off by talking about our list of definitions and noting that this has been proposed as final on our working list. And I believe we have not received any. Our last comment on this was from Christine Duran. Okay. So let's take a quick look at her updates, because I mean I think we're very close to just closing this off and saying that our definitional terms are closed, and there is no way I can read that from here, Lars. So it's like, oh, okay, I think I got something here.
How about that?
Yeah, perfect. So really, this is not an edit, but a comment. And it's with regard to supplemental rules. Supplemental rules shall mean those rules adopted by the registry operator in case of first level disputes as set forth below. And I'm sorry, I skipped one here. The previous comment, it looks like Christine has tacked on a comment to the definition of respondent. Suggests that we not imply a two-party dispute. Discussions have indicated that in the case of multi-party hops, there may be more than one party. The registrar of record needs to be a party so that they can implement the decision to transfer. Gaining registrar at the fraudulent transfer needs to be a party to provide FOA, etc. So I think that that is an important item to take note. I think that this, to some extent, is covered by the use of the word or. We could certainly more explicitly cover this by saying and or. And I think that would address... Holly's shaking her head. Is that overkill? Or are we? It's overkill? Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine. Holly said off microphone, she thinks that might be overkill. Anyone else have any strong feelings or just... I think this is a good point to notice as something certainly we discussed at length. So I think that if it's not explicitly captured in this definition, it's certainly what we intended, so let's just make sure we're all comfortable that it's covered. Okay. And then moving to the second one, the registry operator in the case of first level disputes, certainly this would be struck or stricken from the definition if indeed our final recommendation is to remove the registry layer. This becomes a deprecated piece of language that we can just throw it overboard. And I believe that was it. So, pending the decision of what to do with that little blurb about registries, can we, as a group, say that we have completed our definitional work on this PDP? Is everybody... We can put this one to bed, finally? Okay. No more zombie definitions, everyone. Thank you very much for your help and for working through that. Okay, there is one other support document I thought, and Lars, you may not have it queued up. I don't even know if you brought it with you to London. Do you remember we were going through a number of use cases as well? And I think that that was also intended to be an appendix or an annex to the report. We haven't looked at it in a long time, so I don't mean to spring it on this group here, but I think that it's important to note that if we have made any significant changes between the initial report and the final report to this annex, we should make sure that everyone has had a chance to sign off on those. So I seem to recall that we went through this at a fairly high level of or fairly low level of, I guess, high level of detail, and made some fairly significant changes. In fact, one of the biggest issues was, if you take a look at there was one of the items there that was covering disputes between parties, number 8, I believe. We rolled up a number of these scenarios into number 8, so I think this document at one point was much larger.
Yes.
So...
This is the
microphone.
Yes, I mean, I'm happy to put up the red line version, but this is the after we discussed and rolled it into 8. This is the clean version after the group discussions.
Thank you. So, really, I think that we've given this particular annex a number of passes through the working group. I think it is incumbent upon us as members to take a look at this and make sure that we are all still fine with the latest and greatest version that cleaned up all the edits. So if we could, please, I don't believe we're meeting next Monday, but we're meeting the Monday following. So if you could, between now and then, take one last look, and if you spot anything that you want to change, raise it at our last and final meeting. Otherwise, we will consider silence to be acceptance and agreement. Go ahead, Lars.
Yeah, this is Lars. I will send around a red line version and this version, if you want both of them, to the list later today or tomorrow, but well in time before the next meeting. So you should have it all in the inbox.
Thanks, Lars. I think that'll help. And certainly recognize that folks probably won't be able to have eyes on that until they're on the flight home, or train home, or car home, or pony home, or however they got here. But I think wanted to make sure and emphasize that we've spent quite a bit of time on these two supporting documents. We determined that they were important enough to include in our report, so let's make sure we've got them right, but we don't want to leave them open indefinitely. So, and then that brings us to the main body of the report and the outstanding issues that we have there. So I don't know if we still have... I look at Lars, he's going to... He's furiously working to pull up all the different documents. Can we go to the comment review tool here? He's very quick. He's not as quick as those guys from Ghana, but he's pretty quick.
Well, those guys from Portugal.
Yeah, I saw that. We tied. We're not even supposed to be here, and we're winning. So, you know. Just think how far you've sunk now. You're arguing with an American about soccer. That's pretty low.
Who was the NBA player of the year last season?
I don't know. I have no idea. Probably a Canadian. Right, Graham? Yeah. Okay. Was, seriously?
It could be.
I don't know. He was?
Can we stop the sport and get back to the matter at hand?
Yeah, we're killing time until Lars can pull up the document, and here it is. Thank you very much, Lars. He could not resist the troll effort there. He just couldn't let that one. Had to swing at that pitch. So, another sports analogy.
This is Angie Graves while we're in group mode.
Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, I had to put this call on hold for a minute. I'm not sure if I'm listening well.
I could barely hear you, Angie. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
My foot is still on hold for a moment.
I'm sorry, Angie. Your audio is so garbled. Is it possible you could put it into the chat?
Will do.
Okay, we heard those two words. Thank you very much, Angie. I think it. We'll just wait for her comment to come in chat because we're having some audio difficulties. So it looks like we're starting off. Which page are we on there, Lars? Okay. So if we could direct folks to page 5 in the document. I believe everyone has scroll control. And we are looking now at which comment number, please?
7.
Oh, recommendation 7, comment number 15. Is that correct?
Yeah, so recommendation 7 is that we recommend that the... incorrect.
That's okay. You're
recommendation 9, page 6.
Thank you. That's more familiar. Okay, so recommendation 9. This is the recommendation from the working group that the registry level of the dispute be eliminated and that all disputes now be directed to... Well, really, let's be honest. There are two mechanisms for dispute. There still remains the informal mechanism where registrars work together to reverse an invalid transfer if they can agree. This is more dealing, this comment at this issue is now dealing with the formal dispute, the TDRP, the one that we've determined has occurs very rarely and typically in cases where the two registrars do not agree whether or not a transfer was valid conducted according to the policy. So what we're saying in this, in our recommendation in general, is that that needs to, all of those need to be handled by the current third-party dispute provider, that the registries would no longer need to support this function, that given the number of registries now coming online, the opportunities for this process to become inconsistently applied are approaching 100%. And I think the concern, we have a couple of comments here. One coming from the registry stakeholder group, that they, in effect, I believe, supported the recommendation and agree that they could be removed from this function. And then there was another comment from Arthur, who, by the way, has joined us. So, hello, Arthur. So thank you for coming. Another comment from Arthur addressing the issues about the fees. And I think that opened a broader conversation about the economic impact of this, which should not be disregarded, because initiating this transfer dispute with a registry has traditionally been, I don't want to say free, but fairly low cost, while initiating it with a third-party dispute provider is not. However, as we've noted, it's very, very rarely used at all. So the scope of the, while the impact may be high on an individual case or an incident per incident basis, the scope is not very broad. So Arthur, if you don't mind, if I could put you on the spot for just a moment, and you could walk us through your particular concerns about eliminating or opine on your thoughts with regard to this, about eliminating the registry level dispute, and do you agree with the working group recommendation? Do you not support this recommendation?
Okay. I was not aware that the registry offers dispute service at a lower cost. I was of the impression that disputes would always cost the third-party panel fee. In general, though, due to the low number of occurrences of these transfer disputes, I would recommend that the registry or ICANN funds these costs as much as possible, because it's otherwise preventive of fighting for the registered name holder interests. In other words, if you charge the registrar a fee, then the registrar will charge the registered name holder a fee, and unless the domain name is very valuable and is very important, many registered name holders, in my humble opinion, give up or have already given up under the current policy and lack of transparency. Now, in particular, I believe there was a Twitter account that was lost by somebody with a very beautiful Twitter account name. He was informed, in fact, by GoDaddy, but that doesn't really matter, that, you're not the registered name holder anymore, so we cannot help you, more or less bumping into a registrant policy or lack thereof, rather than the inter-registrar transfer policy or possible improvements therein. So about the fees and about the disputes themselves, I think they should indeed be done by either the registry or ICANN or a third-party panel. It doesn't really matter that much, as long as they are done consistently. And I would encourage the fees to be as low as possible, so that we can protect the interests of all registered name holders, not just those who are economically strong enough to pay up.
Okay, thank you, Arthur. I want to see if we have anyone in the queue, but before we do, I just want to emphasize for clarity that particular incident with the Twitter account was a social engineering effort. And completely unrelated to the transfer policy.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was someone who had gained access to a customer account that should not have had it. So I just want to get that clarified. I don't know that any of this would have helped that particular case at all.
I agree.
And I think that we do recognize that we don't want to create undue burdens or barriers to accessing dispute resources for registrants who've been victimized by any kind of a fraudulent transfer. However, the other side of it is also, I'm noting that Christine is not here, but I think that she might recognize that there are there's quite a bit of investigative and judicial type work that's done on the part of the dispute providers to resolve and make decisions on these issues as well. And so it's certainly a balancing act. What about the rest of the group? Do we have any other thoughts on the fee structure? And certainly would love to hear opinions that might support Arthur, or counter opinions, or I know everyone's checking their emails. It's good Wi-Fi in here. Yeah, not in the rooms. So. Oh, she is. Fantastic. Christine, do you have any way of weighing in via audio? I have a very rudimentary... Barry, you can tell him I'm here.
She's here.
No mic access. Okay.
Hi,
Christine. So, you know, I mean, maybe I can just step out and weigh in as a, you know, I don't think that those concerns are invalid. I think they're legitimate. But I think that, you know, when creating policies like this that are going to affect the whole ecosystem, it's always going to be a balancing act. I think there is the danger that someone somewhere at some future date will be prevented from accessing or slowed perhaps from accessing a dispute resource. And then the question is turned around, so how much of a burden should we put on the rest of the industry to prevent against the possibility of that scenario? And I think that's the balancing act that we're trying to achieve. What helped me solidify my position was the headcount, the fact that this is happening even in very, very large TLDs at a rate of, you know, maybe Barbara can give me some actual numbers, but a very low rate, and other GTLDs that have been in existence for many years have not seen this policy invoked at all. And yet they are maintaining trained and support resources continuously just in case they ever receive one. So, you know, my position is that we got it right, but that we should acknowledge that concern in our report, and that it's something that we certainly should be open to monitoring and revising as a community if we feel that it has become an endemic problem, and that ICANN starts to, or, you know, compliance or staff starts to receive, or registrars for that matter, start to receive numerous complaints that they're being shut out of dispute resources because of the price. But I'm really looking for, you know, this is not a James and Arthur conversation. Anyone else be willing to weigh in on this? Graham?
Sure. Just to agree with you, James, I think Toucaus has seen one in 15 years. They're extremely rare for us, so it seems like that's we've achieved there what I agree with you is a reasonable balance. Yeah, and as long as we're willing to keep that sort of option open for future discussion, then I feel like we're pretty solid. Sorry, that was Graham Bundon for the transcript.
Thanks, Graham. And I also want to say it's not necessarily true that a registrar would pass those fees along to a customer if they believe that they were at fault, or they believe that they wanted to do this as a matter of keeping the account, keeping the customer happy. It's certainly something that they could absorb on their own. So, you know, it's possible that they could. Arthur wants to weigh in. Go ahead.
Definitely. I must admit that the presence of the fees does encourage outreach between registrars, by which I think the majority of cases that, you know, would otherwise go to a dispute procedure can be solved before ever going there. So it's also an incentive for registrars to continue to outreach and to continue to work together. That said, from the perspective of a registered name holder, they have no idea that the option exists, what the costs are, and why they should burden or carry the burden of cost. It's difficult to explain to a customer who pays $10 a year that they now that they now have to pay $1,000 to get their domain name back because of the third-party resolution provider. I don't know if VeriSign is cheaper than that. Just the these concerns that I've added to the IRTP working group as well as other issues mainly stem from the perspective of the registered name holder, which I think is not being heard or addressed directly or specifically enough by the current policy. So besides just the fee itself, it's more to do with how do you communicate the options that are there right now to affected and disenfranchised registered name holders to begin with. So even if we keep the fees, we should still communicate the options to the relevant registered name holders or to all of them more more clearly as part of the IRTP policy.
Thank you, Arthur. So we do now have Christine on the line on the telephone bridge. So we definitely would, before we move on, maybe give her an opportunity to weigh in if she'd like. I would point out that one of the other recommendations is for ICANN to maintain a website where we registrars can link to and direct concerns, registrar concerns, registered name holders to timely and current information on their options and the fees associated. So hopefully that part of your comment will be addressed by another recommendation that those resources be created and that registrars be obligated to link to them. But for right now, we'll go to Christine. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah, this is Christine. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, great, thanks. Welcome. Okay, so this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum, and thanks for the dialogue. I appreciate it. I popped in kind of late. So, with respect to the fees, those of you who've been on the weekly calls know that this has sort of been something that I've popped up. I've raised several times because we want to be sensitive to the fact that we know the registries are charging less. But what we're bringing to the table, of course, is, experienced licensed attorneys who, have to review the case file, take several hours to do the review and several, and then draft a written decision that gets published online. Because that's the new recommendation, is that it'll be published online. And they're doing this for a flat rate of roughly $800. And I won't say a flat rate, they get a percentage of what we collect, but for a single domain name, it's $800. And so the thing of it is really thinking, from the perspective of we have to hire an attorney to do this. One of the things that we haven't gotten into as a group that I think we need to eventually, or at least make a recommendation that there's an implementation team around, which is other alternatives such as the provider retains a specialist who handles all of these cases, which would mean there wouldn't be a rotation amongst panelists. There would probably just be the same one or two people who would get all the TDRP cases. Again, once you get somebody a certain amount of volume, they get a certain comfort level with the types of disputes there are and that sort of thing. So I think as a group and as a community, there are a few options with respect to how the fees could be structured in a way that would be a little bit less harsh for the parties at play, parties that are in the disputes. But I really am sensitive to the fact that, the amount that we're able to do this process for is not similar to what the registries are able to do it for currently. And so I think there does have to be a serious discussion about where any funding differences could be made up or whatnot, so that we make sure to continue to provide the quality product and that consistency that that everyone's looking for.
Thank you, Christine. Appreciate your perspectives on this. And I think that, you had a point in there regarding, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. It was in the middle part there regarding, I'm stuck on where you ended, but Can you help me?
Were you thinking about the part where I talked about the different options, such as having a specialist or...
No, it was right before that. Sorry. I was writing notes, and then I asked Marika how much time we had, and I lost track of my train of thought, so I apologized for doing too many things at once. Oh, it's not your fault. It's my fault. But you had made a comment there, I think, about it was right before talking about having a dedicated panelist that is specific or specialist that is specific to this issue that's not rotated around. And I think that there was a comment that relates to another one of our recommendations. Okay, we'll come back to it. So, this is kind of where we're landing here. I think is that a recognition or an acknowledgement that this could be a problem in the future, but that the scope and the scale is so small that that it's something that we should keep an eye on, but not necessarily unbalance the recommendation. I'd like to propose, as a way forward, that we maintain our original recommendation as it is. However, note the concern that was raised by Arthur. And I think, I think Mikey raised this topic as well before departing about the fee differential. And just understand that it could become a barrier and that it is something that we should keep an eye on and perhaps address as a community or through ICANN staff. The bit about... recommending to Christine's point about recommending that providers maintain a specialist that deals only with transfer disputes, I don't think that's a bad idea at all. I don't know that it can be baked into a requirement for a dispute provider at this point, but it's certainly something that we could include in our recommendations that would be adopted for them by them on a on a best practice level. So I would just, I don't know, any thoughts? Anyone like to disagree with that approach, build on that, add to it, amend it, modify it? Arthur, go ahead.
It might still be a possibility in the future, of course, that that the fee may become preventative, but we already know what the fee is, $800 or thousands. If there's such a low number of cases per year, then what is $40,000 to ICANN per year? In other words, is it not something we should pick up the bill as a community, as an insurance, for if your house burns down and you're the victim of a hacker attack, your domain is transferred away, that the community pays for your legal costs because you're involving a lawyer and all kinds of offline mechanisms to enforce online ownership or the rights to a domain name, because you never own a domain name. But to protect somebody's rights, the price for protecting that, given the number of low cases, is actually quite is low enough to just pay that as a community, while at the same time requiring registrar outreach, at the same time, enforcing that we should always try to solve it between ourselves first. So, although, for the specific charter questions of the IRTPD, it may be that for now we keep the fees as is because of the arguments that have already been made by the group, but strictly speaking, from the registered name holder perspective, we're not changing it, and the domain names that are not interesting enough will not be defended, or will not be those name holders will not pay the fee, and neither will the registrars. Because why would I keep a customer with one domain name and pay $1,000 for him, and I will earn that back on that particular customer after 100 years of renewals, but the customer will probably be dead before I make a profit.
Actually, so we can move on then, I think, because Lars had asked to be in the queue. But I just want to emphasize, one customer can tweet a bad experience and cost you 100 customers, in, through social media. So I don't want to assume that just because a registrar is incurring a fee that they won't you know, absorb that in the name of good customer service. It certainly is possible that they would. It is very dependent upon, it is very situational, and that's why I think we have to be careful when we make, you know, broad policy implementations. So,
not everybody is a GoDaddy that would protect their reputation that way. So, speaking from perhaps for the majority of the smaller registrars, I would feel, and the resellers in particular, I can guarantee you that resellers will not fund the transfer dispute costs. In particular, looking at the cases that have been made at all under the transfer disputes, they have all been filed by major registrars. Like all the transfer disputes that I've seen that are on file, all of them have been made by the large incumbents. Now, it's not to play the blame game at all, but simply that if you want to protect the registered name holders for the resellers as well, I would encourage still and maintain the position that the fees need to be lifted, while at the same time encouraging outreach and enforcing a dialogue before allowing a free dispute.
Okay, so Marika, you wanted to go next?
This is Marika, maybe just a suggestion, because I know you all don't want to talk about it, but presumably at some point we'll do a review, I guess, again, of how certain changes are working. And one thing in relation to the TDRP may be that instead of indeed making any changes now, but just note this as an item and possibly conduct a survey at the time and basically ask registrars, why are you using the TDRP or why aren't you, and really see is indeed the cost a prohibitive factor, and then at that point in time maybe further explore. And I think at that point hopefully as well the IRTPEC question may be addressed and the other aspects of dispute have been identified, and maybe it's a combination at that point where you review the existing mechanisms and actually also have some questions indeed. Is that really the cost that is prohibitive, or are there other elements that are perceived not to be working? So that may
so I guess I'm not clear. This feedback from registrars would be sought before, as part of the implementation of this PDP, or as part of a review once the implementation of this PDP has gone live for a while?
Yeah, this is Rick. I think more the second, the latter. And again, it may be something as well to take together with the work you're foreseeing on doing once IRTP Part C is implemented, and in relation to the case studies, noting that there are some, you know, at that stage you will know whether more work needs to be done in relation to dispute resolution mechanisms or management, if not everything is covered, and that may be then taken as part of that or part of a future review.
Thank you. Thanks. Lars, you're up next.
Yeah, this is Lars. I would have to go back through the transcript. So I believe that Mikey at the time, we discussed this with the fee issue was discussed during the group, if I recall correctly. And obviously the problem is, on the one hand side, fees can be prohibitive, but having somebody else absorb the costs also then can encourage frivolous action, and then that's the other side of the same argument, that all of a sudden you have a lot of transfers that are legitimate, but they will go through the provider because they the registry level no longer there. The cost will go up considerably, and the number of cases might go up considerably too. The cost for ICANN or whoever else might cover it if it's no longer the registrars who are actually launching the procedure in the first place. So it's something the group discussed. I'm just saying that as a reminder.
I concur with what Marika says, and perhaps a slight fee should still be in place to prevent abuse, similar to the AGP that you can, you know, up to 10%. I don't know.
Thanks, yes, and I think we all know when something is reduced to free, what happens to it? So I have Volker in the queue next, and then I wanted to kind of, anyone else want to weigh in on this subject? Because we are getting to a point where we can wind down and then open up for questions, but we also have a couple of other topics that we wanted to open up. I don't know if time allows. We have the room. I just don't want to assume that we have the people. So Volker, go ahead.
Yes, you made a point exactly. When it becomes free, then it becomes something of a game that people might play to see if they can get an advantage out of the system, a lottery, so to speak. We've discussed this at length during the working group discussions, and we found that it is, on the one hand, very problematic to have a party pay that has no interest in this proceeding, because that will not cause any proceedings to proceed in the future, or the process to stay as unused as it is today. So what we're trying to do is to find a process that is actually more used than the process today, but making it free or making it payable by registrars per se might not be the right way to go, because either way would not solve the problem that we're seeking to solve here.
Thank you, Volker. So gathering all of this feedback, I think where we can land is that in our initial recommendation, to acknowledge that this could become an issue, the fee differential, to propose that we monitor this issue and that it become part of any sort of follow-up review to ensure that the fee differences are not becoming a barrier for registered name holders to accessing the policy, or a barrier to registrars, to Volker's point, from initiating the policy on behalf of their registrant customers. And if it's determined, then we should examine some sort of a model where ICANN is reimbursing partially or fully those disputes that are successfully reversed. And I think that would prohibit some of the frivolous stuff that we're talking about as well. And I'm thinking, and Lars, I know I'm kind of putting it onto you to go back to the transcript here, but I think that should capture all the different points and concerns while leaving our recommendation mostly intact. We'll move on from there. I'm not able to think and chew bubblegum at the same time. So no problem. Holly is excusing herself for another meeting. Thank you for coming, Holly. Bye. Okay. So let's talk about, at least give a window or an opportunity here for the folks who don't normally participate in the working group to weigh in on these subjects if they choose. Any of the subjects, really, not just the one that we were addressing previously. Before we move on to our next issue, which is I believe was either the FOA issue or the other one. So does anyone – I can't see behind me. Does anyone in the room here have a question, want to get in the queue? This gentleman here, we'll start with you. And then anyone in the back, please, there's extra seats at the table. Don't feel like, this is a place of privilege. It's like Thanksgiving. You're all welcome here. Come on up. Sit down. So, okay.
Benay Garcia, hi, Boo. I'm curious what's driving the fees. If in the discussion I'm tracking, they seem to be a little malleable, but they also seem to be quite hefty. And I'm wondering, is that just a function of some sort of standard, or is there some sort of mechanics involved? What drives those?
So I should probably let Christine field that question, and I think she did touch on it a little bit, but the fact that an independent dispute provider has to hire panelists or specialists to review and investigate and make a determination, and in some cases these are experts in this field or folks who are trained in arbitration of disputes. Or former judges or something of that nature are usually hired and retained for this purpose. But Christine, do you want to weigh in on this? If we can put you on the spot.
Yeah, James, this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum for the transcript. You hit it on the head, James. So the fee that we charge is $1,300 for a single member or a single domain name dispute, and two-thirds of that goes to the panelist who considers the case. They are a licensed attorney with at least 15 years of legal experience and specialized experience in internet domain names and trademarks and that sort of thing. I know trademarks are not specifically relevant to the TDRP, but we use our UDRP panelists, so that's why I reference that. They review the case file and write a decision just like you would get, from a traditional arbitration or a court case, and then, send down the order. The remainder of the fee is used for processing for our staff and our legal counsel. So it's pretty involved here. So every case is looked at by internal legal counsel, case coordinators, and then, of course, decisions are made by the independent expert panelists. So that's why the fees are what they are. The fees haven't gone up in probably close to 10 years, maybe 8 years. So they're kind of rock bottom for the process as is. I made a suggestion in the chat that you know, I'm loving this discussion. I would love it if we could schedule some time in one of our future calls to just brainstorm implementation, like, options. You know, I throw out the idea of having a dedicated panelist. Maybe that's not the right answer. I don't know. But I think there are things that we could do to think about streamlining the costs to make it more user-friendly and cost-friendly. But when you want the expert, unfortunately, that comes with the expert price tag as well.
Thank you, Christine. Does that address your question? Okay. Excellent. And thanks for that comprehensive response. Is anyone behind me raising their hands wanting to get in the queue? I can't really. Okay. And any other comments from anyone else at the table? Okay. So let's move then to, let's just quick do a quick time check. It's 2:33.
Yeah.
Yes. Hello?
For the queue. Can someone let me in the room, please?
Is this...
Can someone let me in the chat?
Is that Angie?
Angie, yes.
She wants. I think she. Are you not able to enter the Adobe room?
Correct.
Okay. Make sure that it's a different Adobe room than the one that we use on our weekly calls, Angie. You would have to go to the ICANN London schedule, and the link is there. And if we could maybe have someone post it to the mailing list or send it to Angie directly, we'll try and expedite getting you that link. But it's a different Adobe room, tied to this physical room. It's in the invite that you received today. And we just found out does not have audio support. Right. Well, that's why we had to call Christine.
Oh,
not too late. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the next issue we discussed, let's hold the FOA issue. What was the third one, Lars?
6 to 12 months.
The 6 to 12 months. Yeah, thanks. The statute of limitations. And so here's the introduction very quickly is that from the time of an invalid transfer, you have currently 6 months to initiate a dispute. This group, as part of our initial report, has recommended extending that to 12 months. The thinking behind it, the justification was that in 6 months' time, it may not be sufficient for a registrant to even know that their domain name has been transferred if it's not something that they are monitoring on a regular basis. However, by extending the time period to 12 months, then it should be able to get their attention in one of two ways. One is that the renewal notifications would not be received, and that that would get their attention when they go to renew the domain name, assuming it's on an annual basis, which is common but not necessarily universal. And then secondly, that it would ICANN, who is data policy, reminder policy, notifications asking them to update their WHOIS data would not arrive. This is, so just laying this out here, this is hopefully would get their attention that their domain name no longer belongs to them and has been transferred and give them ample time to initiate a dispute if it has in fact been illegitimately transferred. I would point out that these are absences of communication, so it's much harder to pin down than an actual, you know, discrete email address being received. It's more like something didn't happen that you were expecting as opposed to something happening to get your attention as a registrant. I don't know that we had any other concerns raised. Perhaps there was some concern that extending this from 6 to 12 months might open a larger window for any disputed secondary market transactions, so that any buying and selling of domain names, if those transactions were to go south or result in some kind of a disagreement, that someone might file a dispute. You know, I don't know if that's a legitimate concern or not, but it is something that frequently comes up when we discuss this topic. The working group recommended that that we'd make this extension, and I'm not sure we received a few comments on this, correct, Lars? Yes, okay, thank you. And it's recommendation number 5. 5, thank you. And so going back to... Yeah. So just to address these, I think that we, as a working group, we determined that there really was no immediate action required at this time. But we certainly wanted to give everyone one last chance to weigh in on this topic and see if there were any amendments or modifications proposed to the working group. So, any comments or thoughts on this, Lars?
Yeah, and even to reiterate maybe also why you would like to stick to 6 months, because there were comments by Thomas Rickert and by the ALAC especially, who said they want to have it extended to 12. Just to point you to that.
Yes, thanks. I think Thomas Rickert actually made that comment in the Singapore meeting during the council update.
Yes,
that it was that even 12 months was not going to be sufficient. Is that correct? He wanted it extended.
No, it's 12 months, and he provided then something in writing, which is here, comment number 11.
Okay. So comment 11, can we summarize here that that he was an additional 3 months? Yeah, that's what I'm seeing. Who's asking for 15 months? Yeah, and we were saying that that we acknowledged his point on this, but noted that in the balance between a 15-month extension and a 6-month extension, that 12 months seemed to be a reasonable compromise to address all of the concerns at hand. So, and then we had a comment from staff on this as well. So I think that I haven't seen a lot of traffic on this either in the last couple of meetings or on the list. I think that we are probably good with the 12 months. If we need to expand the language of our justifications in this associated with this recommendation in our final report to acknowledge the concerns that were raised in the public comment, then we can certainly do so. But I think that our original recommendation, that we can go forward with that. Yes. Bennett?
Yeah. Bennett Garcia. Do you have data on when on the cadence of disputing? So you say, okay, well, 6 months wasn't good enough. A year. Is there data that shows what that curve looks like?
I think we did pull some basic data, but the sample size was incredibly small really didn't – I don't think that we – it didn't support the idea that they were all happening within the first week, and neither did it support the idea that everyone was running out of time at 5 months and 28 days. So I think that
so this was a question I asked in the general policy meeting they did for new members was, mm-hmm. when you're setting up a policy, do you ever put a switch in for review of that policy based on a change in the data?
Oh, not based on a change of data, no. And I would say that effort is just now getting underway in its infancy. And Barry, maybe you could speak to the data and metrics working group that's addressing very
Thursday
similar
morning.
To that question. Yes.
Yes. This is Barry for the record. So I think despite the data and metrics for policymaking working group, we're internally making a much more concerted effort to ensure that once a consensus policy is implemented, it's part of the implementation framework, that we will start monitoring that policy through the compliance, contractual compliance function. And like Marika noted earlier, this is a fairly extensive change, and not that I'm wishing that there's a whole bunch of volume in regards to TERP, but that is something that we will take a look at. And if we do see that the 12 months is, whether it's working or whether it's not, I believe that we will be reporting back to the community on how that was implemented and watch it. And certainly if anything is out of character, we would report that back to the council to look to have it be deliberated on.
And just to expand on that, I think that a lot of the participants on this working group are registries and registrars. Would like to see most policymaking trend in that direction, so that not only are they triggered, any kind of a review triggered by data, but that data is used to substantiate the actual problem that we're looking to solve, and I'm being careful here, to validate the solutions that are being proposed, that the cure is not going to be worse than the disease. Because I think that when we deal with very, very large numbers within ICANN, within an ICANN framework, it's easy to say, I saw this happen 100 times, therefore it must be a terrible problem and we need an industry-wide policy, whereas a service provider, we can say, you know, we've seen this transaction happen over a million times a month without a problem, so 100 bad incidents is really not even, you know, a rounding error. So I think putting things into perspective and making sure that the solutions match the scope of the problem is something that I think that the service providers could certainly get behind that effort. So, but I think that unfortunately with this particular issue, when you're dealing with a subset of a couple of dozen incidents over a decade, it is hard to draw any conclusions at all that that 6 months is either not enough time or too much or 12 months is too much time. It's really a matter of just adding a layer of protection that we think should be there without burdening everyone else. So, okay, any other thoughts on this comment? Just to remind folks that we are now 14 minutes over. Yes? I can't see who has a hand up. Christine. Okay, go ahead, Christine.
Oh, hi, thanks. This is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. So I just wanted to make an anecdotal observation, which is that the few handful of disputes we've seen, which I think is six, have been pretty quick. And I think, and I wanted to tie this back only because I think it ties into the pricing, because obviously we are a higher price than the registry, or we're an appeal level for the registry at this point. So the few cases we've seen where people who thought that domain name was very valuable, I believe they noticed the loss or experienced the loss or the neck pretty quickly. And didn't really wait. You know, they wanted something to happen, or something did happen. They brought the dispute to the registry. It came to us. You know, they were willing to pay the fee. So I think there's a little bit of I think there's two levels in play here. And I think we talked about it when we talked about fees. And I think it was Arthur who said something too that, you know, maybe the fees might, you know, weigh in also. And that is, the TDRP would almost be more of a mechanism, you know, a kind of a quick get my domain name back mechanism for the more valuable names, and might be overlooked for the less valuable names. Just an anecdotal thought.
Thank you, Christine. And I think that your anecdotes are helpful in the absence of data, just because of the position that your company occupies. So just to note that we are 15 minutes past the close of the meeting. We gained and lost working group member Chris Japlow. Thanks, Chris, and thanks for coming. And we have the room, as Marika indicated. We could probably keep the room to the top of the hour, but I certainly don't want to presume, or maybe a little longer, but I don't want to presume that everyone's schedule supports that. So if you need to leave, you know, certainly don't feel like you're being impolite. So the final issue that we had on our final report, and it comes from some comments that were submitted by Arthur, who's joined us here in London, as well as Rob Golding. Is that right? Yeah, Rob Golding from a registrar. And Rob is not here. I thought he was based here. I thought we were going to see Rob. But Rob's not here with us today. And this is regard to the continued necessity of the FOA. And the working group's initial recommendation is that the FOA should be preserved, that it is majority of transfers, it is just an extra box to be checked or an extra step. It can cause problems or confusions if the customer does not quite understand what to do with an FOA. However, in the event that we are trying to address a transfer problem or dispute, and I'm not talking about formal disputes that go all the way to Christine's organization, I'm talking about just inter-registrar disputes, which are much more frequent than the small numbers that we're talking about for TDRP, that those forms of authorization are in fact essential. The only audit trail that's established between registrars. I think that we had a very fruitful discussion, very healthy discussion on this on our last call on this issue. I think that we have generally arrived at the idea that the FOA is still essential, It is noteworthy that it can cause confusion, and then perhaps this this ICANN resource for disputes and for transfer information might help, you know, at least provide some avenues for customers to educate and for registrars to help educate their registrants. But in general, I don't know that I don't know that we've moved much, if at all, from our original recommendation. So I wanted to put this on the table for a further discussion today. We can give it at least another 15-20 minutes discussion on top of the you know, hours that we've invested and weeks that we've invested into this topic. But certainly want to give everyone an opportunity to weigh in on this one more time so that we can be sure that we're comprehensively accounting for all views in our report. So any of the other folks or even the folks in the audience, or does anyone have any questions, first of all, what we're... No? Okay. All right. So any other thoughts on this? Arthur?
Yeah, I'd definitely like to clarify my position on the FOA as it has changed a bit from removing it completely to changing it to a non-blocking form of administration, of form of confirmation. In other words, I agree that an email to the original registered name holder in particular is useful for tracking who the original registered name holder was and who is complaining now, especially for the inter-registrar disputes, not the official disputes. I agree, because we have experience with that and did indeed make use of the emails. However, the mentioning of you saying an extra step is in particularly problematic, because each extra step that you ask a registered name holder or a customer, anyone on earth, to take will drop your conversion. So the more steps you ask, the less conversion you get on a successful transfer. In other words, because you introduce, and in my opinion, three steps, but maybe even a four-step process in terms of transfers, when you compare them to CCTLD transfers, because you add all these extra steps, you are encouraging registered name holders with a legitimate desire to transfer their domain away from a registrar to give up that endeavor and to stay with the losing or current registrar. Now, my recommendation to the group with respect to the FOA emails is to maintain them, but not in a blocking way. In other words, please change them to a form of confirmation after the registrar transfer has taken place to the original holder, and make it easier for if the should there be a dispute afterwards, that it makes it easier for the registered name holder to contact their registrar, or indeed the gaining registrar, and at the same time reducing the dependability of a successful transfer on the accuracy of the email address in the WIS, because in many cases the email address in the WIS is either too old, or it's from the losing registrar, it's not from the registered name holder, it's from a reseller. The email address is so problematic in many cases where the legitimate, or at least the paying entity for the domain name wishes to change their supplier, in other words, to choose a new registrar, and this extra step should not be blocking. Should be taken, but it should not be blocking, in my opinion, because it limits the process and drops conversion and limits migration of domains, and it's an anti-competitive, becoming an or already an anti-competitive step, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you, Arthur, and thank you for clarifying the difference between your position now and the position that was submitted in the public comment. I think that's good, and we'll make sure to update that. Volker?
First of all, personally, on a personal level, on a technical implementation level, I agree with Arthur. The form of authorization is a pain. It limits conversion, and it's a problem to migrate large domain portfolios, especially. However, it is at this time the only way to actually contact the domain owner, because the form the auth code may be also handled by a lot of in-between parties that may not be the domain owner. So the presentation of the auth code alone is not evidence that the domain holder wants to transfer the domain name. Furthermore, as registrars, we are under the 2013 registration agreement already required to perform a validation of the email address. The form of authorization that we send out takes the place of that validation because it already fulfills the requirement of that validation. When you transfer a domain name in, you have to make sure that the email is correct. If you own a domain name that has incorrect Whois data, i.e. an incorrect email address, then you must fix that email address before you've transferred the domain name out. It's as simple as that. That's a validation requirement that we already have. And we tied that to the form of authorization for the transfer. So actually, you don't have to send out two emails. You just have to send out one. And that takes both functions.
Okay, thank you, Volker. I put myself in the queue, but I saw Arthur jump forward. Did you want to respond quickly?
Yeah, quickly. About not being the real registered name holder, I think that the exchange of an authorization code between the acting entity and the gaining registrar is sufficient proof of the registered name holder desire to transfer their domain name. And the reason I think that is because in many cases, in many ICANN policies, there is no consideration for resellers at all. We all talk about the registered name holder and the importance of contacting the registered name holder, but if you are not given the email address of the registered name holder, which the policy requires, but let's say that you're not getting it, then you, no matter how many emails you send, you're still not contacting the real registered name holder. Now, the exchange of the authorization code is not done haphazardly. It's not done easily. You know, you have to do some effort to get an authorization code, and you have to do some effort to submit an authorization code, and that alone is already enough of a burden and enough steps to check a transfer. Indeed, many CCTLD registries limit themselves to just the authorization code. So why on earth are GTLD transfers not only adding an extra burden in the form of an email that is not just informative but is blocking, and as well having a client transfer prohibited status in the Whois that also has to be put to the status okay. So the GTLD transfer process adds two extra steps that are a burden, that are not effective, that do not additionally confirm the wish of the registered name holder to transfer, which is already covered by the authorization code as evidenced by the other CCTLD transfer policies. And in short, it remains an extra step.
Okay, thanks. I think we're clear on that. I want to go to Volker and then Chris. And then I would put myself in the queue, and then I want to bring this in for a landing. So, Volker?
Just to reiterate, looking at the requirements of the RAA to verify the contact data, it is not actually an extra step. It's, as it can be combined with a step that you have to take in validating the email address before you transfer a domain name of the new registrant. So, yes, it is an extra step when you consider only the transfer, but when you also consider your verification obligation under the RAA, it's not.
Thank you, Volker. Chris?
With regards to the point Arthur made, the APP code, or transfer secret, whatever you wish to call it, could easily be gained from any way or any number of hacking ways from a registrar's database. So having the extra part of confirmation, albeit yes, you could fake the registrant email address to confirm it, or the admin email address, to confirm it, is one point. The CCTLD that Arthur made the point of, they are still in control of it, and a registrant can generally talk to a CCTLD provider, whereas they cannot talk to a GTLD provider.
Thanks, Chris, and I think that is an important distinction. I put myself in the queue just to weigh in on this topic from the perspective of a registrar. I think that when we looked at this, the idea of eliminating an FOA from our perspective was considered to be really a non-starter. It's really a critical piece of verifying that the transfer was – confirming the transfer was the wish of the registered name holder. To Arthur's point about, well, let's convert this from a required prerequisite confirmation to, I think, more of an after-the-fact notification – so that we increase the conversion rate of transfers. I think that that's something that, you know, I'd like to gather some data on that and understand what the impact of something like that would be. Offhand, I'm a little skeptical. I think that would definitely increase the successful transfer rate, but I also believe that that would increase the transfer reversal rate because, you know, the safeguard, one layer of safeguard would be removed, and if we're dealing with very large numbers, it only takes a very, very small percentage of failures to trigger a large number of disputes. So I would want to take a look at that and understand exactly where we're going. I think from speaking with our internal teams, we'd be much more comfortable with some sort of a two-factor confirmation of transfers, and right now we, the industry, are using the FOA as that second factor. Now, if it's not what we want or not what we want, if we want to change it, then we should at some point. But I think that you know, that's something that warrants a little bit more study. So we can come back to this topic, and I'll try and gather some data. We can come back to this topic on our next thing. I was trying to wind this up, but we'll give Bennett the last word.
Okay,
and then we'll bring it in for a landing because we're at the top of the hour. Go ahead, Bennett.
So this might work. This might be interesting for large people, but like we have a very large customer base that is small businesses, and those cats do not look at their emails. They don't answer their emails. They don't. We literally have to get them on the phone to talk to them. And so if this is counting on someone checking an email to make something happen, you're setting yourself up for creating a problem that didn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I followed that. So you're setting yourself up, registrant is setting themselves
up? Well, if you're setting a process in place that requires someone to have an email or respond to an email, they won't. There's no one there. There's no one home. They're not looking at their email.
Much like the domain validation issue.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess I know that that is common, but I also know that this has been a part of the transfer policy now going on almost 15 years, and it's been added to recently by ICANN's requirements that we validate not only on an annual basis, send out an annual Who is Data Reminder email, but also validate that the email is alive and that someone is monitoring it as part of the new RAA validation. So point is just that, I think that the message from an industry perspective, whether registrars are doing this, it's coming from ICANN, is that if you want to be a registrant in this industry, you have to have an email address that you check for even the most basic functions, like using your domain name, registering a new one, or keeping your Whois data up to date on an annual basis. I would love to see all email communications between us, the registrar, go away, unless the ones that we choose. But I just we're pretty deeply invested in this idea, I think, as an industry, that we have to have a way of.
We actually have data on how often somebody sees an email, and it's not high.
Yeah, totally agree and understand. But I think that while the rest of the world may be moving to, for example, SMS as a second factor,
mm-hmm.
this industry is doubling down on email communications. And hey, we just got rid of faxes a couple of years ago as well. So I do note that we are now at the top of the hour. I'm sorry, Ben, can you restate your affiliation? You were saying as a large service provider.
So we're a company called Hibu, and we have, what would you say, Graham, in the neighborhood of over 600,000 domains at this point?
And that's a registrar, reseller?
As a reseller.
Reseller.
And so those are small businesses in two countries, just those numbers, not counting the Spanish ones or the South American ones that we do.
Okay.
That's just UK and the US.
Okay, thank you.
That's
thank you. Okay. All right. Well, I did want to extend my thanks to everyone, the regular working group participants, as well as the new folks that have joined us here in London and contributed to our discussions. Our next meeting
If I could respond to what Volker and the other people said, that they were lying. There are just factual inaccuracies here.
Hold on, please. We've given you, I think, ample opportunity to weigh in, and I would encourage you to join our next meeting, which is going to be not this coming Monday after ICANN, not a week from, but 2 weeks from today. We'll be at 15 UTC. And I think that we've certainly valued everyone's contributions here, and including the public comment and in this forum. And if you want to continue this discussion, I would encourage you to join the working group by submitting your statement of interest and becoming a member of the working group. I know we're almost at the end, but we can certainly use some additional help. No, just got here. So, thank you. But we are gonna close up now. Thanks.